I'm going to talk on attosecond pulse carrier envelope phase effects because it is the closest thing to control that my group and I have done recently, and that fits in with this workshop. Tomorrow, for those who are interested, I will give some other talk about some other work privately with Misha and Olga about harmonic generation, which was just accepted, a paper which was just accepted in Preserved Letters last week.
But starting before you go ahead, the schedule says that Naveed Khanija is going to speak tomorrow.
That's right.
He's not going to speak tomorrow. He's not. He's going to speak next week.
Oh, really?
So tomorrow we're actually, the program is open, and I think we want to use it for some kind of more informal discussion.
That's one opportunity.
Oh, that's one opportunity. If you want to use it for this,
yeah, we can discuss.
That would be okay. Or so to be now.
Better it would be better in the afternoon for me. I could do it at 10:30.
Okay.
But I should know today. But I'm going to be playing squash this evening.
Okay.
And so I don't have much time tonight to prepare.
You have your squash game. This is the priorities must be
seen. Yes. Okay, so let's get on with this, because this my group and I have been working on this for going on 2 years now, and at the end I will give our most recent work, which is either submitted or about to be submitted. This work was started with my two postdocs, Langyu Peng, who's now a professor at Peking University in Beijing. And by the way, we've proposed an attosecond workshop at KITP Beijing in 2 years with Andre Bandrock. And so he is the main Chinese contact, and then Evgeny Pronin is from the Manikoff group. He's my postdoc now in Lincoln. And yes.
Are there other sister sites, or is that the only
one? No, that's the only one. That's relatively new.
Siemens one in Holland.
And apparently this month they should decide whether they're going to approve our proposal or not. So sometime this month we'll find out whether we're going to be spending a month in Beijing. Okay, so I want to motivate why we began this investigation, which the motivation really relates to KITP, and then briefly discuss the theoretical method and give the results for a single attosecond pulse, two attosecond pulses, the interesting effects of indition IR pulse, and then talk about our recent work. This is in review, and I hope it should be accepted soon, on the effect of pulse chirp. And then this is about to be submitted if my postdoc and I can agree on notation. And that is what I'm working on here now, an analytic description of these effects. And I will show you the results. Okay, so the motivation is really this paper that appeared in Science in 2006 by the Italian group of Nisoli in Milan, I think. And what they achieved were attosecond pulses of 130 attosecond width with stable carrier envelope phase, and not only stable but tunable by having the beam go through an aluminum sheet of metal, and the fact that this is a one or two cycle pulse, depending on whether you measure it at half width or the full width. This is a quote from their article. And the way this relates to KITP is that 3 years ago, Andrei Bandrak and I organized an attosecond workshop here. And the first week of our workshop was an attosecond science conference. And as those of you who've organized things here know, the KITP has strict regulations on when you can start, when you or especially when you can stop. And we filled up our conference. It was just chock full. And because of the caterers and the rules here about when people have to go home, we had to stop at a certain time every day. And so the second day of the conference, Nisoli gives me a call and says, hey, I have these fantastic results. Can I give an invited talk at your conference? This is, and he had declined. We had invited him to come, but he had not accepted. And so then I told him, no, we can't because we're just full up. Unless, I said, somebody doesn't show up, but everybody showed up. And so Anne Willier reported his results. She spent 5 minutes of her invited talk reporting these results. But this got me and my group interested in, now that one has few cycle attosecond pulses, what can you do with them? In particular, as it relates to this workshop, what can you do with them to control electrons? Just last year, the Garkin group, not to be outdone, achieved 80 attosecond pulses, again, a few cycles. And so one has few cycle attosecond pulses, and I should say that the fact that you have a few cycle pulse is not new. What's new is that it's in the attosecond regime, which means the bandwidths are enormous. Just some other related work, Paulus et al. Showed in this Nature paper 8 years ago now, the carrier envelope phase effects for a few cycle IR pulse. They just showed that you can make an electron go to the right or to the left. Andre Bandrauk considered a few cycle IR pulse plus an attosecond pulse and showed that you can determine by using the time delay between these to determine the IR pulse. And then the Lund group of Anne Willier, together with the theory group in Louisiana State of Ken Schaefer and Meta Garda, have been investigating attosecond pulse trains and kicking up electron wave packets and showing how the wave packets can be manipulated by an IR field. And Ken talked about some of this work. He talked about this work especially in his talk here a couple of weeks ago. But in our work, all of these works that use attosecond pulses, they're using many cycle attosecond pulses. What we're looking at are the few cycle attosecond pulses and seeing what happens when you have one or two attosecond pulses with or without an IR field. So just briefly, our theoretical method, we solve the three-dimensional time-dependent Schrodinger equation, although we use linearly polarized light so that the by symmetry, the dimensions are reduced. The zero-order Hamiltonian is the we make an effective single particle approximation, but this atomic potential for hydrogen is a pure Coulomb potential, and for helium is a one electron potential designed for helium developed by Hartree. And the interaction here with the laser fields is given in velocity approximation, but we've done calculations in length approximation, length gauge, and the results agree. So these are the potentials we use for hydrogen and helium. And here's the source for the Hartree potential for helium. So in general, we consider up to two attosecond pulses. If we only have one, then you set this coefficient equal to zero. They have independent carrier envelope phases. They're separated in time by a time delay, TD. And they may have different frequencies. The pulse envelope is a sine squared envelope. And the field strength is given in terms of the vector potential in this way. And of course, to solve the time dependent Schrodinger equation, we have the usual expansion and spherical harmonics. And in these calculations, we consider L's up to 15. And the coupling term between different angular momentum channels, is given by these expressions here, which are nothing unusual. So our numerical methods to march along the coordinates, we use a central finite difference method. In time, we use an Arnoldi method, and this paper gives some of the details. And as for looking at what happens after the pulse ends, we then project the numerical time-dependent wave function onto incoming Coulomb waves, which are the eigenstates of the zero-order Hamiltonian. And these are normalized in momentum space. So then the observables are the absolute square of this projection, which gives a probability in energy and angle of the outgoing electron. And the total probability in momentum equals the total probability in energy and angle, as it should. Okay, so now let's look at the results. For a single few cycle attosecond pulse, this shows the distribution of electrons. This is X and Z. By symmetry, we can ignore momentum in the Y direction and only consider momentum in X and Z. The polarization is linear. It's along the Z-axis. And you can see visually that these are not symmetric, that there's more amplitude in the lower half plane than in the upper half plane. And we choose a particularly high intensity in order to see the effects, because the maximum intensity at which attosecond pulses can be obtained now is quite weak. Reinhold Kienberger tells us if he does things right, he thinks he can approach 10 to the 14 watts per centimeter squared. Mark Racking said he doubts that, but this is an order of magnitude larger, and for reasons that will be explained later, but you see these asymmetries at the higher intensities. And so anticipating where experiment will go next, we assume a higher intensity than can be achieved now. But it's still...
Tony, just a very quick question. Obviously, these are non-perturbative effects. This is why you need such a high intensity.
No, these are perturbative.
But
it's nonlinear, but it's perturbative.
Ah, okay, nonlinear, but sorry. So it's the measure.
It could be linear also.
What?
Linear will not depend on the carrier envelope phase.
That's right.
No, of course it will, because it's just one photon, two photon interference within the.
Yeah, but that's that's nonlinear. In the field, because but we'll see.
I was just wondering, given the high intensity and the fact that you may absorb more than one photon, is the box large enough and stuff like that?
Our box is 2,400 atomic units.
Good God.
So it's plenty big. There's no reflection. No reflection. But yes, I mean, to anticipate what I'll show you, these are nonlinear effects, but there still can be described perturbatively. If I ever get to the end, I'll show you our perturbative analysis of this. And I think Peter Lambropoulos has indicated that for laser fields up to 10 to the 16 watts per centimeter squared, perturbation theory works fine. Sure. But these are high frequencies, so it should work. Okay, so what do you get? For reasons that I will explain soon, I'm showing here for the attosecond pulse the vector potential. And you see here that we make the vector potential go to zero before and after the pulse. And to get the electric field, you take the time derivative of this. And here we have four diagrams showing the electrons emitted along the polarization axis or opposite to the polarization axis. These are the solid and dash curves, and you see they differ. And here's the carrier envelope phase of this attosecond pulse. So zero means right in the center, it's zero. Whereas pi over 2 shows that in the vector potential is the maximum right in the center of the pulse. And as you can see, for this single ionization case, for an attosecond pulse with pi over 2 carrier envelope phase, you get a distinct separation between electrons kicked to the left or the right. The electrons are ionized by the attosecond pulse, and they're distributed in angle. So in the previous slide that showed here, what I'm doing is I'm just taking a cut along this axis and folding it, so I compare the electrons in the lower half plane with the electrons in the upper half plane along the kx equals zero direction. And you can see that they're asymmetric. So this asymmetry is a characteristic of having a few cycle pulse. And here we compare helium and hydrogen. I should say that our attosecond pulses are designed to be identical to the Italian groups, because that's why we got started on this, except for the intensity. So,
can we say a word about this? Probably a simple, classical, physical explanation of why the dotted one is more to the higher energy.
Yes. Let me get the lights here. I mean, the electric field is minus 1 over C dAdt. Okay. And the force on an electron is minus EP. Right? And the force is dPdt. So you have the change in momentum for an electron that's kicked up delta P. It's minus E, the integral. Okay, and E of t, we have this. So this is E. Did I do this right? E over C, the integral dA dt dt from the time the electron is put in the continuum to infinity. And so this integral, and A at infinity is zero, as I showed you. So we have that delta P is minus EE over C, A at T0. And so for a positive vector potential, you get a negative impulse. And so a distribution that for a many-cycle pulse would be symmetric along the axis, if you have a few-cycle pulse with its peak positive, you get a net negative momentum shift.
But how do you know what T0 is? Surely there is a whole span of T0s.
Usually you get the most ionization at the peak of the pulse.
Well, but there is ionization also at the other regions.
That's probably, but you get the full distribution.
Yeah, you get a distribution. So in principle, you would have to average this. That's why you get such a fat distribution. I mean, this pulse has a big energy spread.
What bothers me is that, of course, if it's a full cycle pulse, the integral over et dt is zero.
No, but the T0 is when the electron is put in.
Everything depends on the assumption that the electron, quantum mechanics, of course, doesn't allow the electron just to jump at any given time. The field acts and starts ionizing. So this is a long process. It's not just doesn't happen instantaneously. And everything here seen in this model seems to depend that on the electron really being ionized.
This is a hand-waving explanation of what the solution of the time-dependent Schrodinger equation is giving you. So there's no approximation in solving it other than that we have a...
No, when you solve it, for sure it's true. I'm just asking about this hand-waving explanation.
Well, this is how I understand it. That if you have a pulse, you look at where the peak is, that's where most of the electrons are, that most of the probability occurs, and then that electron in the continuum is influenced by the rest of the vector potential.
So in order to, if I were thinking about what's the fundamental limit on how much asymmetry I could have, basically, I would need a half cycle out of second pulse.
Right. Right. And but
then
you can't.
Can I get one lobe without the other?
That's right. And we have a paper that did that for femtosecond pulses.
There is an alternative explanation which I alluded to, that if he has a full octave, then of course he has the fundamental second harmonic.
Yes.
And we know the interference rate is symmetry.
That's right. I mean, this work relates. This relates to your talk and to Paul's talk.
I find it more. More appealing.
I have to say. Well, you'll see our analytical description is exactly that. Okay.
It would be interesting if the classical gave the same direction.
It will.
I don't think so. It doesn't have to. This was a big argument that we had with Zeldovich in the old days, and because he had a purely classical model, and in fact, because there is a matrix element of the material that is quantum mechanical, it can change the phase dependence. So as you change the envelope phase, you may actually get something which is not classical.
Right. All right, I will get to these points. So helium and hydrogen, the main difference is that we have a 36 eV central frequency for the pulse, and the binding energy of helium is 24 eV. The binding energy for hydrogen is about 13 eV. And so the kinetic energy is much higher here than here. Still, the shapes, as you go up in intensity, this is 5 times 10 to the 13, 5 times 10 to the 14, 5 times 10 to the 15. This is about the limit of where, somewhere between here is the limit of where experiment can possibly get. as far as attosecond pulse intensities, and you can see that there are differences, but they're small. Once you get to the 10 to the 15th, the differences are quite sizable, both for hydrogen and for helium. And now, Ferenc Krauss asked me when he first saw these results, well, you know, our attosecond pulses, he said, are 90 eV, so what would you expect as you change the energy of the pulse? And we thought about that, and based on this hand-waving model, this is a very interesting point. Based on this, we just hypothesized that the asymmetries should be similar if, when you kick the electron in the continuum, the vector potentials are the same, so that the momentum impulse is the same. We see here that the magnitude of the vector potential, if you take the time derivative for a sinusoidally varying thing, you see that the magnitude of the electric field is approximately omega times the magnitude of the vector potential. So A0 is of the order of E0 over omega, which is of the order of the square root of the intensity over omega. So we hypothesized that you would get similar behavior if the vector potentials of the two XUV pulses are the same. So what that means is, if you, in this example, if you change the frequency by a factor of 2, or the central frequency, then you must change the intensity by a factor of 4. And this shows you, for hydrogen, what happens for a 36 eV pulse, 5 times 10 to the 13, or a frequency twice as big, 72 eV, and an intensity 4 times as big, 2 times 10 to the 14, you see the results are really quite similar. And so this hand-waving scaling law of how these asymmetries vary with frequency is approximately okay. Now, what's interesting is that when Paulus and Krauss and so on discussed few cycle pulses, they said, obviously, for a few cycle pulse, it makes no sense to talk about the ponderable motive potential. And in strong field physics, the ponderable motive potential is very important. The ponderable motive potential is said to be the average energy of oscillation of an electron in a laser field. So they said, well, obviously, if you have just few cycles, there isn't much oscillation, and so it just doesn't make sense to talk about the ponderable motive potential.
But as an outsider to this field, I've heard a lot in the last few weeks about the three-step model. And there, even within a single cycle, people are referring the cutoff to the 3.17 times the ponderable motive. So it's coming in even within a half a cycle.
That's right. But what's interesting, I mean, they wrote a paper in Science, or was it Nature? I mean, one of these big journals, and they said that it makes no sense to talk about the pun. It turns out that the vector potential, if you square it, is directly proportional to the vector potential, because the ponderable motive potential. If you square that, that's proportional to the intensity over the frequency squared, and the ponderable motive potential is I over 4 omega squared. So it's interesting that, you know, everybody agrees that when you have a many-cycle pulse, the ponderable motive potential is a very important parameter. Turns out for few cycle pulses, if you say the vector potential is important, it's really related.
It just establishes the scale of energy, which is a very convenient energy scale. Yeah. Whether it averages or not is not so relevant.
Okay, so now to get to Moshe's point and to the talks we heard from Moshe and Paul, we looked at the intensity dependence of the carrier envelope phase-induced asymmetries. And you can, there are three quantities in these graphs. One is the total ionization probability, that is, the electrons in the lower half plane, which we call P minus, the probability of ionizing in the lower half plane, plus the probability of ionizing in the upper half plane, that's the total ionization probability. We find, as shown in this graph, that that's linear in intensity. These are our calculations for hydrogen and for helium. Both, and the straight lines are a fit to the data points we have here. So these are our time-dependent Schrodinger equation results, integrated. And these lines are least squares fits. And to, if I remember right, at least two significant figures. I mean, the difference is in the third significant figure, it's linear. So we only give two digits here. The difference between electrons ionized in the lower half plane and upper half plane goes as the 3/2 power.
Well, the asymmetry actually comes from the fact that I is not independent of time, right?
Yes, the field is not.
Yes.
So the I here is then chosen as the peak on.
That's right. That's right. But the difference between electrons ionized in the lower half plane, which are the majority, so we put P minus first, minus P plus, goes as the intensity to the 3/2, which implies, if you think about it, an interference between one photon and two photon processes, because the two photon process is proportional to I squared, the one photon process is proportional to I. So the interference of their amplitudes would be proportional to the 3/2. And then if you define an asymmetry parameter, which would be the difference over the sum, then you have I to the 3/2 over I to the 1. That should vary as I to the square root of I. And that's what you get here. Again, I think I remember instead of 0.5, we got like 0.497 in our least squares fit.
Now, I mean, there are probably also processes like let's say just 1 plus 2, 1 plus 3 also. Yes, such a broad pulse.
If you do, I mean, you don't always, I mean, because that takes a much broader pulse already.
And that does not break the symmetry.
No. 1 plus 3.
So 1 plus 2 breaks the symmetry, 2 plus 4.
No, and 1 plus 2, don't get worried about the parity.
But you have the differential cross section. So in differential cross section, you don't average over all the angles, and therefore they interfere very well. If you average over all the angles, that term will go away.
Yeah. Okay. So now, briefly, what happens when you have two attosecond pulses?
Did you just go back to slide? I mean, this relates directly to what I was talking about, as you said, in the sense that I claimed that the alternative picture, we actually look at the field and you draw the field in a sort of classical way, and you discuss what happens to the current, is, you know, the classical limit of the picture, and that's what you're saying. So I'm wondering, did you just try to do this, actually expand your simple model and do that classically?
Classically? No, we haven't tried to do it classically. Yes.
Not hard to do, and you just drive it with this single cycle pulse or few cycle pulse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how good. I mean, this is an argument that is qualitative. I'm just wondering how quantitatively accurate this is, because if you look at the pictures we showed, when H bar gets small enough, i.e. when you get close enough to the classical limit, the agreement between the dynamics in the presence of the field quantum mechanically and the dynamics in the presence of the field classically was virtually exact. So it would be really interesting from my point of view to see what happens if you go to the classical.
If you have time, maybe after my talk, we can talk about that.
But this omega is so large, then how can the classical approximation work for an interaction of a field with such a large omega?
what's wrong with that?
It's a high frequency.
It's a high frequency.
Stability and in classical limit, quasi-classical limit of quantum susceptibility is equal to classical susceptibility and also in high frequency limit. And in high frequency limit, you can get beautiful expressions.
But this is not susceptibility. That's exactly my point. That it is entangled. Yeah, but it's entangled, and therefore, also the matrix elements of each process.
I bet donuts that I can write a simple SFA like strong field approximation like model that will work just fine unless you already did it.
We did.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, then.
But the strong field
approximation. But we tried to publish.
It's not what Paul.
Yeah, we tried to publish the SFA results, and the referees said, either you solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, or this paper should be rejected. And so we solved the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and it was accepted.
But I think the thing is that in the SFA, you do a saddle point.
Oh, no. Here, you would do the Bessel functions. Here, I would write down, of course, the same S matrix amplitude. I will also ignore the Coulomb potential from the continuum because that's exactly what Tony did on the board. And I will expand the bulk of phase in the Bessel functions. Yeah. All I would need would
I'll
be J0 and J1. Yeah. And that would do the
I'll show you a comparison. The best SFA.
Sorry. Let's keep it.
So.
I'm still willing to argue that.
Yes.
Can be extended directly.
Okay. Let's talk about that later. Let's consider two attosecond pulses, and when you have two, and we assume that the two pulses are separated by, since attosecond pulses are generally produced by Thai sapphire lasers, we're assuming that the time delay of the pulses is of the order of a half cycle of the Thai sapphire laser. Okay, and. They're intense because that's where you see the effects most dramatically, and we're assuming durations of two cycles. And if I now take a cut through this, you see lots of interference in this plot. If we now take a cut for k equals zero and look at what we get. This is looking down now for here are the vector potentials for the two attosecond pulses. They each here have a zero carry envelope phase. Here one has 0.5 pi carry envelope phase, the other has zero, and here they both have pi over 2 carry envelope phase, which means the maximum vector potential is at the center of the pulse where it has peak amplitude. And you may be able to see that the most asymmetry is in this case where both have this pi over 2. And in what follows, I'm going to take a cut at k equals 0 and show, because you see the results more clearly. But first, I'm going to make a strong field approximation estimate as to where the minima occur. If you have two pulses, then you can, quantum mechanically, the amplitude is the square of the amplitudes of each pulse, and you can lump the relative phase between the two amplitudes into one exponential phase factor there. Okay, and then you take the square of this, and you see that the probability in energy and angle is the sum of the probabilities of each pulse plus this interference term between the two pulses, which where you have this cosine of the phase difference. This phase difference, if you had an electron with an energy, initial energy of minus EB, and you ionize it to an energy E, then the relative phase between electrons that aren't yet ionized is E plus EB times the time delay between the pulses, as well as the carry envelope phase difference of the two pulses. So the minima in the probability distribution, according to the SFA in the simple model, is where this phase is an odd multiple of pi, so that you get minus 1 here. If you set that equal to 2m plus 1 pi and solve for the energies at which the minima occur, you get this expression. And you can see that the spacing between the minima is independent of angle, which we find in our time-dependent Schrodinger calculations. These are nice circles. And it's inversely proportional to the time delay between the pulses, and the carrier envelope phase comes in only as the difference here. And if we now look at these cuts, the solid line gives the predictions of that simple SFA approximation, and the curves are the exact solutions of the time-dependent Schrodinger equation for these two pulses.
This is something very basic.
Yes.
Why is the physics of helium being so different from the physics of hydrogen? Hydrogen, you just have a single smooth envelope.
No. What I showed you before were a single attosecond pulse. Now I have two attosecond pulses that are producing two electron wave packets that are interfering with each other. And so this is the interference between the two wave packets as a function of electron energy. The SFA prediction for where the minima should occur, you see, is close to where the time-dependent Schrodinger equation result says it should be, but the difference is due to the effect of the Coulomb field. You can see that even in these two-pulse effects, the electrons kicked out along the polarization axis or opposite to it differ substantially. And so there are dependencies on the carrier envelope phase. And in fact, these differences, you see, when both have pi over 2, are much greater than when one is a carrier envelope phase of 0 and the other pi over 2. And this shows hydrogen. You see, the previous one was helium, this is hydrogen. The results are not as dramatic as for helium, probably because the kinetic energies are much higher. This just shows that if you have two attosecond pulses that differ by a carrier envelope phase of pi, that you get no asymmetry. This is just from the symmetry of the situation. And this indicates that an attosecond pulse train, even if it's few cycle, would not give an asymmetry in the electron distribution, because in an attosecond pulse train, the successive attosecond pulses differ by a phase of pi. Okay, so the most interesting thing are what happens when you have an additional
There should still be very minor differences, shouldn't there, between left and right? Or no? Up and down. It just because...
Yes, yes. There will be differences because any electrons kicked up by the first pulse will be affected by the second pulse. But we're in our time-dependent Schrodinger equation results do take that into account. So there are, but it's small, as you can see. So now, what happens if you have an IR pulse? And so this is a single attosecond pulse ionization. The IR pulse is here in all cases, but here is a particularly weak intensity. The intensity is low enough in all cases that you don't get ionization of hydrogen by the IR field. So the main effect of the IR field is when the XUV pulse kicks up an electron, it sees this infrared field. And this is the asymmetry you see for electrons along pi or 0 degrees relative to the linear polarization axis. For a carrier envelope phase of pi over 2 in the XUV pulse here. And now if you place this XUV pulse, this is to scale, right in the center of the IR field, where the carrier envelope phase is 0, where the vector potential is 0, then you would expect, based on these arguments, since the vector potential is 0, you would expect the momentum shift to be 0. And that's what you see. When you place the XUV pulse right at a 0 of the IR field, the asymmetry is nearly unchanged. However, when you put the XUV pulse at a maximum of the vector potential of the IR pulse, then you get a huge, in this case, enhancement, because this is positive and this is also positive, so both are positive here. So you get an enhancement of this asymmetry, which is due to the IR field. Now, if you have a carrier envelope phase of 0 for the XUV pulse, then again, there's very little asymmetry in this case, but nevertheless, the IR field causes an asymmetry.
Can I just ask?
Yes.
Again, coming from a point of view of ignorance, it seems there's an interest in putting IR pulses on top of these out-of-second pulses, because you mentioned that this was done before. Not this calculation, but
right.
The idea of that. What was the motivation for putting an IR on top of the...
Well, the point is you always have an IR, because the IR field is what is used in harmonic generation to generate the out-of-second pulse. And the Lund group is particularly interested in seeing how the IR field can control electron wave packets. Yes?
I just wanted to add, I think the main motivation was that the second metrology. Because if you want to characterize your XUV pulse, then you add IR field, and that you have different schemes like spider, frog, strict camera,
right.
But the
frog, crab.
Yes.
There's frog, crab. There's a paper, several papers actually, by
right.
Meres and Curry.
The main idea that basically you create replica due to IR field, you create replica of photoelectron distribution created by the XUV pulse, and then you can characterize the XUV pulse because the interference would record the phase of XUV pulse and therefore characterize the pulse for you. So that was the main, that was the main motivation, original motivation.
You could also characterize the IR field.
Exactly, both, yeah.
So metrology is the sexy word. Although metrologists are usually not held in high repute, so because they're predictions.
Quantum metrology.
Yes, quantum. That sounds better as opposed to classical. Okay, so now let's get to the interesting stuff. Let's turn up the IR field. So this is 10 times higher now, but still weak that it doesn't cause ionization. You start, you get these tremendous enhancements, whether the carrier envelope phase of the attosecond pulse is 0 or pi over 2, you get these tremendous enhancements due to the vector potential of the IR field. But what's most interesting is this structure that begins to appear. And this is a plot of this structure. You see these rings. because of the IR field, the electrons are predominantly sent, given negative momenta. Very few have positive momenta. And you, if you look carefully, you see the spacing of the rings is different up here than it is down here. And I'm going to take a cut, again, along kx equals 0 to bring out these differences. So this shows positive momenta and negative momenta. You see the bulk of the ionization is for negative momenta, very little for positive momenta. But if you look at the peaks there that gave these rings in the previous slide, you see the blue lines give twice the IR frequency spacing. Whereas here, the blue lines give the IR frequency. And you can see that on either side, you have differences in the IR spacing. And so what's going on? Though it's been a year, we still haven't a definitive explanation, in part because we my postdoc moved to China, and in part because we got involved in two other aspects that I may get to show you briefly. But the let's look at the differences here. You see that the structures both occur for low electron energies. You also know that the IR, if you kick up an electron, the IR field gives it a downward momentum. And so if the XUV pulse kicks up an electron with positive momentum, the IR field is sending it to lower momenta. The lowest positive energy electrons kicked up by the XEV pulse could be given negative momenta by the IR field, which means they head toward the potential, the Coulomb potential, and could, in principle, be rescattered back. If they rescatter elastically, they could come back with whatever negative momenta they had in this direction. But then electrons that had much higher momenta and that were sent to that same positive but lower momenta by the IR field could interfere. You have a which way experiment. You don't know whether the electrons started out with high energy and moved to lower energy, or whether they started out with low energy, moved to negative energy, and were rescattered and came back here. The point is you have the opportunity for an interference. And it's interesting that if you plot IR right between, that's where you have minima. Of course, there are only three obvious peaks there. The other thing that could happen if you have low energies is that as long as the electron is in the vicinity of a potential, it could absorb IR photons. The field here is weak enough that it doesn't ionize electrons, but once the electrons are in the continuum, if they're in the presence of a potential, they can absorb IR photons. And so for those electrons that have negative momenta, if they're slow, as long as they're in the vicinity of the potential, they could absorb IR photons. And so having peaks spaced by the IR frequency makes sense. The fact that the XUV pulse is at the peak of the IR pulse means that when the IR pulse turns around, and we're using a four-cycle IR pulse, when it turns around, the amplitude will be lower. And so these negative momentum electrons may not be rescattered, or in any case, they're less likely to be undergo any rescattering than the positive ones. What we want to do is really do a time delay experiment of the XUV with the IR, now that my former postdoc has gotten established in the past year in Beijing and has a group. That's the next thing we plan to do. But let me show you results we did before he left that further explain this scenario. First, just a repeat of the dependence on the IR pulse intensity. Here, the IR pulse intensity is increasing by a factor of 10 in each slide, and you can see that there's no structure for weak IR field. It's beginning here at 10 to the 12th. By 10 to the 13th, you see the structure. And so clearly the structure has to do with having an intense IR pulse. On the other hand, let's vary the XUV pulse intensity. If you vary the XUV pulse intensity, if you look at the numbers here, maybe you can't see them, but they just go up linearly by a factor of 10 as the XUV intensity goes up by a factor of 10. And the structure is almost invariant to the intensity of the XUV pulse. So the XUV pulse is just putting the electron in the continuum. This is the most interesting slide, that here we're varying the frequency and the number of cycles in the XUV pulse. Now, if you increase the number of cycles, that means the bandwidth of the electron distribution goes down. So this lower row are four-cycle pulses. Upper row are two-cycle pulses, as are all the other work shown so far. Here's 36 eV and 93 eV. These are the Garking results. These are the Milan frequencies. As you can see, when you have a two-cycle pulse of either intensity, the bandwidth is enormous, and you get the structure for low energies. When you go to four cycles, the bandwidth is much less, and there's no structure any longer. So what these have shown is that these interesting structures have to do with having wide bandwidth and in the presence of an IR field. And let me now briefly show something. This probably, I hope, will appear soon. We've responded to generally positive referee reports. What happens when you have a chirped attosecond pulse? The key thing here is that the frequency is time dependent in a chirped pulse. The amplitude, however, as my experimental colleagues at Nebraska tell me, the energy in the pulse is constant, whether you chirp it or not. And so the chirp is measured by this parameter, xi, and this is how the frequency varies linearly with xi. The amplitude decreases as the chirp goes up, and the envelope behaves in this way. So the pulse bandwidth, on the other hand, doesn't depend on the chirp. The energy in the pulse does not depend on the chirp, but the pulse duration looks like increases, and the intensity decreases. So if I show this is a transform limited pulse, the dotted line, and these are positive and negative chirp, the dashed line and the solid line, you can see that positive chirp, the dashed line, the frequency is gradually increasing as time increases. It's the reverse for the negative chirp, and you see they're much longer than the transform limited pulse. So what effect does that have on these asymmetries? Well, this is for hydrogen. You can see that here's zero chirp. These are what I showed you before. You get these asymmetries if the XEV pulse has a carriable phase of pi over 2. But now, if you put on a chirp, here's positive, here's negative, you can see that where you get the asymmetry goes to zero, that point in energy changes. And in fact, there's another one here. So that the structure becomes much more sensitive to the energy. When you don't have a chirp, things are pretty smooth and go in one way. When you have the chirp, you can get these crossings where the asymmetry reverses sign. This shows you the difference between electrons at 0 degrees and pi degrees as a function of chirp. Here's zero chirp. Here's the difference as a function of electron energy. There's one crossing here, and otherwise, but then as the chirp increases, you see there's one crossing, two crossings here, one, two, three crossings. By the time you get to 3.5, the number of reversals of the asymmetry increases a lot. And this shows a similar behavior for the asymmetry parameter. And this shows that even with a chirp, so these are curves for a fixed chirp, this is the asymmetry parameter as a function of carrier envelope phase, you can see that even a chirp pulse has significant dependence on the carrier envelope phase. Okay, so these are, if you, because the work on the theory is in progress, that's another slide. So, and I won't spend much more time. I mean, I won't go beyond the 2 o'clock. But just to summarize so far, we've seen that the carrier phases of few cycle attosecond pulses produce asymmetries in the ionized electron momentum distribution for intensities within earshot or of current capabilities. Weak IR pulses can augment the CEP phases. The interesting thing here that we have yet to fully explore is that an IR field may allow one to explore rescattering of ionized electrons from the ion core. And the chirp definitely affects the asymmetry. And this provides a tool for controlling electron motion.
The rescattering, was that structure that you showed us that was the, where there was a difference between the up and the down?
Let me, this is not as big as it seems. Okay, let me, what was your question?
In your conclusions, when you
yes?
talked about possibly having a probe of rescattering, that was that structure that you had pointed to, the difference between, in one case you had just 2 omega, and in the case of 1 omega, that was, that, that's a potential probe of rescattering.
That's right, that's right. Okay, so let me sketch what I've been working on here with my postdoc, Evgeny Pronin, and my former postdoc, Mikhail Frolov, who has done the analysis for zero range potentials. Evgeny is doing it for Coulomb potentials. And Nikolai Manikov, with whom I've collaborated for over a decade now. And he sent me some very good postdocs and students. And this hopefully will be submitted before I leave here. And Evgeny has spent a lot of time making this quite fancy, so I apologize for that. What we're going to assume, we're going to try to derive these asymmetries, as Moishe and Paul suggested, as an interference between the amplitudes for 1 photon and 2 photon absorption. So we're treating these asymmetries perturbatively. This is the differential cross-section for ionization. And if you square this, you see you get a zero-order amplitude plus an interference term. This is the pulse. It has a carrier envelope phase here and a central frequency and an overall envelope. And these amplitudes are the one photon in length gauge transition matrix element, and this is the two photon. Where here we have the Green's function between the two photon absorptions. And these F hats are the Fourier transforms of the field here. And Evgeny is particularly expert at hydrogen. He can do analytically and in closed form most of these integrals. As usual, we expand the wave function for the initial state in spherical harmonics and of the final momentum state also in spherical harmonics. And these amplitudes take then this form, the one photon and two photon amplitudes take this form, where these are the matrix elements for the radial matrix elements for a one photon process and the radial matrix elements for a two photon process. And this symbol denotes the sum of, we're assuming that we start from an S state, and L is zero. And so for a two photon process, you can go to S and D. It's the Green's function.
I'm still confused. This comes back to this question of parity from earlier. These are dipole transitions?
Yes.
And so can I get from the same initial state to the same final state by two?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. But it came up in the talks of Paul and Moshe that if you have a very short pulse that has a large bandwidth, then the energy overlap between, quote, one photon absorption and two photon absorption, they may overlap over some range of energy. And so in that case, you can have an interference between the one photon and two photon process.
But it's not the same state, as you said.
That's right.
Yourself.
That's right.
It's a different J. It's a different partial.
That's point. Right.
One is zero and two, and the other is one. They happen to be degenerate in energy, so they interfere in the differential cross-section, but not in the
total. But it's not the same final state.
It's not the same final state. Only in chiral molecules you can have the same
right.
final state.
You can make it the same if we put the detector over there, and then.
Then you don't have the wave frame information, and so if you look at it from momentum, directionality, both partial waves can contribute to the same direction, and you don't know where it came from, so that's why you have interference.
Okay. So anyway, for a zero-range potential, Misha Froloff worked out the one-photon matrix element and the two-photon matrix element. It's some complicated algebraic expression, no special functions. For a Coulomb potential, Evgeny Pronin worked out the one photon amplitude as well as the two photon, and he gets it in terms of hypergeometric functions and Apple functions, but they're too complicated to put on this slide, at least. So what happens to the carrier envelope phase dependence, which is our interest? Well, you have the carrier envelope phase coming here for photon emission, photon absorption. It's interesting that you should, in principle, include emission processes because the bandwidth may be large enough that the emission overlaps the threshold. But we find in these, if we assume that it's not too short a pulse, then we find that these emission processes contribute no more than 5% to the ionization probability, but we include them. So here are the one photon and two photon transitions for absorption of one photon, absorption of two photons, absorption and emission of a photon, absorption of two photons, multiplying this angular dependent dot product between the polarization vector and the momentum direction. And here is again another absorption and emission. And Evgeny has given the forms for these various elements, but because of we're approaching 2 o'clock, I will not spend too much time on this and show you results. This is the carrier envelope phase dependence for interference between one photon and two photon processes, where these coefficients are defined here in terms of the dot product, as I said, between the polarization vector of the field and the momentum vector of the outgoing electron. And we're assuming an arbitrary polarization here. We're not assuming necessarily linear polarization. And this particular form agrees with a physical letter by Rudnath and Esri, who considered a general process of carrier envelope phase sensitivity in which they said it had to do with interference between even and odd absorption of photons. So they give a very general expression. If you just include their one photon and two photon terms, because they go to 3, 4, 5, all the way up to infinity, this form agrees, but of course they don't give these expressions here, which we give, for the angular dependence. And so now here we treat the most general case first, an elliptically polarized pulse. Then this dot product, where epsilon is the polarization for an elliptically polarized pulse, has this form where alpha and beta are the angles between the major and minor axes of the polarization ellipse and the momentum direction, assuming that the measurement is done in the polarization plane, because that's where these effects are maximal. I mean, we have expressions outside of the plane, but then the results are smaller. So the differential cross-section in the polarization plane has this form where L is the degree of linear polarization. So for circularly polarized light, the degree of linear polarization is 0. For linearly polarized light, this is 1. And for elliptically polarized, it's some number between 0 and 1. And this gives the dependence on the phase, where we give analytically all of these matrix elements for hydrogen. We predict also a novel effect that in the polarization plane, you will get two dichroic effects that are quite different. One is a circular dichroism effect. The other is an elliptical dichroism effect. They're not the same. They have different origins. Circular dichroism means that you get different angular distributions for positive and negative circular polarization. And if you have purely circular polarized light, this term is 0 because L, the degree of linear polarization for a circularly polarized beam is 0. So this doesn't contribute when you have pure circular polarization. On the other hand, this term is also 0 for a pure linearly polarized light, because then the degree of circular polarization is 0. So this term only occurs, this dichroism only occurs when you have elliptically polarized light, not circular, not linear. And you see the sign of this term depends on whether it's right or left circularly, right or left elliptical polarization. So we give expressions for these parameters here. This is quite complicated, but it doesn't depend on the phase. These two terms do depend on the carrier envelope phase, as given here, where these are matrix elements that we give.
Just a second.
Yes.
And the origin of circular decrease is this interaction with the scattering potential. So it's basically the question about the matrix elements.
Yes.
So alpha 1 2, alpha 1 1, they come from the potential, from the scattering potential, right?
Yes. Okay, so now in the polarization plane, you can, for a circularly polarized pulse, you can relate these angles to each other, and then the in the polarization plane, the ionization probability takes that form. And so changing the carrier envelope phase is equivalent for circular polarization to a distribution of the electron, a rotation of the ionized electron distribution. For a linearly polarized pulse, one has this expression where the carrier envelope phase comes in here. And this is the angle between the polarization, the linear polarization direction, and the angle at which the momentum of the electron is pointing. And that's that coefficient, and this is this coefficient. And it's the interference term, which is this one, which is linear in the cosine of this angle, that gives you the asymmetry in the ionized electron distribution. Okay, so now we'll finish up. We'll finish before 2. I'm just going to show you some results, pictures. Here we compare with time-dependent Schrodinger equation calculated by Langu Peng versus the predictions of these analytic formulas. And you can see these curves give the time-dependent Schrodinger equation results. These give the analytic formulas. And you can see the curves are not exactly on top of each other, but pretty close. So the analytical form is the perturbative approach to this is working fairly well. Same thing here. This is another example, and the difference between these two, I guess it wasn't put on the slide, and I forget. Okay, so here's a comparison of the hydrogen atom and the zero range potential. You see, for the hydrogen atom, these are the exact results for ionization along the polarization axis and opposite to the polarization axis. Those are these two curves. And if we ignore the interference term, that is, we include the first order perturbation theory result only, you get a result that's between the two. Similarly here, for the zero range potential, but the asymmetry is much larger for the zero range potential, and so the point here is that since zero range potentials are ideal for describing negative ions, the asymmetries are going to be particularly large for negative ions, although you'll see that the amplitudes of the ionization probability are two orders of magnitude lower, because having strong binding gives you more probability of being ionized. And this shows the change with two pulse envelopes, because one might ask, how sensitive are your results to the pulse envelopes? This is a cosine squared pulse, this is a Gaussian pulse. You can see the results are similar, although not identical. And but more importantly, as the number of cycles in each pulse increases, you can see that the asymmetries go away. So the asymmetries are due to short pulses, and they go away for long pulses. And lastly, these last results look at the angular distributions in the plane. and we calculate here the average direction of ionization of the electron. So this is the momentum hat averaged over the distribution. This is a very important parameter because for circular polarization, the magnitude of this average is proportional to the magnitude of the interference term. And so you can measure the properties of the system by in an experiment, measuring this average momentum. And this is an exact expression. The tangent of the angle pointing in that average direction is related to the ellipticity and this, the magnitudes of the amplitude in that way. And for linear polarization, you have that the average k in the x direction is proportional to the difference. This should really be z, I think, but I think Evgeny put the polarization axis as x. And so this difference is proportional to these interference terms. And this shows you a picture of the angular distribution. For linear polarization, you can see that the vector points to negative, the negative, I like to say z-axis, I think he calls this the x-direction. I'll have to correct that. And for circular polarization, you have, for right and left circular polarization, you get these two arrows. The magnitude of the vector relates to the strength of the asymmetry. And it's hard to see here, but there are two yellow or green, I'm yellow-green colorblind, directions for an elliptically polarized pulse. This figure shows the magnitude of the average momentum vector is maximal for linear polarization. It's minimal for right or left circular polarization. And this figure gives the angle. The angle is maximum about 180 degrees for the situation we considered. For circularly, right and left circularly polarized light, you can see here, and it varies in this way. It points along 180 for linearly polarized light. And so conclude, and this is concluding the entire talk, but these conclusions are only for this analytical description, that we've given an analytical description of ionization by an arbitrarily polarized few cycle at a second XUV pulse. Both the angular dependence and the carrier envelope phase dependence have been analyzed. The interference origin of the carrier envelope phase effects in the angular distribution ionized by a few cycle XUV pulse has been shown. These results compare very well with direct solutions of the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, indicating the perturbative nature of this, these carrier envelope phase effects. And our theory predicts both circular elliptical dichroism effects in the angular distributions, and they provide a means to determine the carrier envelope phase in the polarization of the pulse. So, thank you. This is the neat thing. You see, Evgeny was spending all his time on this. But this is really neat.
Postdocs that make talks for you.
Look at this. Look at this.
Provide the content.
Look at this. I mean, he has a table of contents. All I have to do is go to here. If anybody asks a question on the CEP dependence, I just go there. And I can go back to that. There. That's neat. I've never seen that. Okay.
Very impressive.
So, well, people have asked questions all along. Are there any additional questions?
Now, what is the origin of such a noticeable difference between the exact calculation and perturbation theory? is it a contribution of three photon processes or higher orders of perturbation?
Where did you see a big difference?
Oh, there were like 15-20%.
No. I think you're reading the figures.
Okay.
So
that's exactly what you do. Click on the table of contents, and there is an answer to the question, right?
Okay.
So probably misread the curve.
You are talking about the difference between this and this.
Yeah, I thought that's a difference.
No, that's the difference between electrons along 0 degrees and minus pi. The difference between the time domain and Schrodinger equation and the analytical is this difference.
Oh, and that's why the referee asked you to calculate the full time dependent.
No, that was our first paper on this subject. Yes.
Do you understand correctly that the reason for circular difference is that we take omega from this polarization and 2 omega from that polarization? If we have circular polarized field, we have x and y directions of the field. And we take omega from here and 2 omega from here. And if we switch phase between omega to omega, which means we rotate in different direction, then we change our difference pattern.
Yes. I think so.
How do you know?
But I haven't shown.
Omega comes from this and omega from that.
And that's what the polarized difference.
It is this polarized difference.
Oh, that's why.
That's why. I was thinking what polarized difference because the potential is symmetric.
There's a difference between those two.
I think absorbing linear from here, omega from here to omega from here, or the other way. Or the other way. And the phase is opposite then.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Pleasure.
Just a comment that back in 1988 we wrote a paper with Catherine Azaro about the effect of elliptic polarization on the angular distribution, and so that we didn't consider the one photon, two photon, just electric elliptical polarization. Mm-hmm. And there we attributed the effect that I think also contributes here is to creating different end states in the continuum, because of course if elliptic polarization can be viewed as a linear combination of two linear polarization, let's say one is in the z direction, delta m is equal to 0, one is in the x direction, you get delta m equals plus minus 1, these interfere and they introduce asymmetry in the cross section. We calculated this for a molecule, but for an atom. So I think that with elliptic polarization there is already an inherent asymmetry. But of course, I think that what Olga said may enhance this.
Could you send me the reference to that?
Yeah, it was PRL 1988.
PRL 1988, okay.
Okay. But if you take a circular field and no CP, and I think it's a bandwidth that
gives you the one photon, the two photon.
Yeah, because if you would take just a synchrotron pulse, then circular polarized, then we wouldn't have any circular dichroism on atom.
No, but this is elliptic, not circular.
Uh-huh. Elliptic, correct.
Let me ask a question which is actually... It was. I was thinking about it during your talk, but it's connected to something Misha said during his Blackboard talk yesterday. When you drew this electron under elliptically polarized light coming back,
and drew it missing, yes,
and missing. You drew it in an asymmetrical way, so it was narrower in the direction that it was moving, and it was broader in the perpendicular.
It was moving along the main component of the field more, and it was moving less along the weak component of the field.
So you drew the width very asymmetrically.
The width.
Yeah.
Oh, I should have drawn it really
circular.
Yes.
It's just.
I mean, the classical picture is done in one dimension.
Yeah, well, of course it spreads equally in all three dimensions. There's really no reason for it to spread differently. No.
I guess it's only these directions which you're
which
worried
matters.
About.
Yes.
Therefore it's this way.
I'm sure I was wondering.
It was on purpose, but I misled you.
Otherwise I would have had a good question.
I have misled you.
Really?
We're done. It's just a private question. Is it not? Have you or Zhenya or Misha tried the simple strong field approximation for the single the second pulse to see if that provides circular dichroism or not?
See if it provides
circular dichroism. I was not your referee, that's for sure.
Yes.
Because I'm suggesting to do what the referee objected. But it might be.
Why would you want to do this? They already did perturbation theory, and that's going to be the same. You expand SFN vessels, and that's perturbation theory. What's the difference?
Your analytical theory is exact, essentially exact. SFI would be lousy, but it would be much simpler. It would simply be much, much simpler. It will also allow one to differentiate between the effects of the binding potential and just the effects of the field itself.
Yeah.
I'm not pushing.
I have a feeling that the potential is the atomic potential is important, but I'm not sure exactly.
It enters into the matrix element.
That's right.
It enters into the matrix element. So that would be a different matrix element.
I think this is simple enough. I bet everything is. Of course, yeah. Individual.
I will
call Zhenya tonight, and I'll tell you our joke.
He say, "Oh, forget it. We did a much better joke. Why do you love the joke?"
No, he won't. But I'll let you know tomorrow.
Don't tell this to Misha Perloff, because his reaction.
No, his reaction would be horribly.
Should I reserve a room for tomorrow for 2:00?
Sure.
And what should the title?
The title should be
TBA approximation.
I'll send it to you. I'll just give you the title of our prisoner letter.
Okay.
But I can make up a title. It would be analytic description of harmonic generation and application to wavelength scale.
And let somebody find who do it right.
Analytic
description of harmonic generation. With application to wavelength scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the key, just to whet your appetite if you are into that, wavelength scaling is the following. That as Misha showed yesterday, where you have this harmonic plateau, this is 3.2 UP, where this is I over omega squared, which is proportional to lambda squared. Right? So if you want to increase the energy of the highest harmonics you can generate, you should increase the wavelength going to the infrared region. The trouble is, as two Fizzweb letters in the last three, actually, because one of them was ours, three Fizzweb letters in the last 2 years have shown that the yield of the harmonics is proportional to something in the range of lambda to the minus fifth to the minus sixth. So, you get higher energy harmonics, but the yield, although most people were analyzing the yield in the middle of the plateau, the yield drops very fast. What I will show tomorrow is that this ignores the fact that you have a real atom. And it doesn't look in the middle of the plateau, but it looks where you want to look, which is this region, where the highest energy harmonics are. So if you look at the cutoff and you choose properly the atom and you choose the wavelength at which you generate this, you can actually not only get no decrease with wavelength, you can get an increase. That's what I will show in this. There's a couple of things you've got to do about it after some part. Because I think one of the people who did this prediction said, looking here is not interesting because all experimentalists want to look in that region. And you know, at the conference you gave here 2 weeks ago, you had Marangos' group, his postdoctoral student who gave a talk, said, well, everybody knows that if you want to get high harmonics, the intensity is going to drop if you increase the wavelength, so we're going to come up with a different way to get those high harmonics.
So basically, one would do it on molecules, because if you look at the section, if you look at the combination matrix element and see maximum of the combination matrix element due to, for example, sort of constructive interference from two centers, then you can exploit it to and if you choose good wavelengths so that it fits the internuclear distance, then you can get it. Yeah, that's good idea.
So I will show that tomorrow.
And I'll leave the switch of the generation application to rest for re-identification.
Power 5, is it the spread of the wave packet which comes back
for the most part?
Yeah. Because more time spends outside, more it spreads, right?
Yeah. In, it's not only that. In SFA, but the papers that were published refer to the fact that everyone knows that here at the cutoff, SFA in the Lowenstein papers, you may have been a co-author, as far as I remember, Paul Corker and so on. If you look right at the cutoff, you can show that the decrease in the yield goes as lambda to the minus 3. Okay, so now the papers that were done by, the first paper was Agostini and DeMauro. And then it was confirmed by Bergdorfer, who saw some interesting structures. And then we explained what those structures are. All three of those theories, they're all theoretical group, even though the first two were by two experimentalists, confirmed that this is how these harmonics in the center go down. And the general understanding, and Bergdorfer gave a good explanation, is that besides that the here the trajectories are the shortest at the cutoff, you have the shortest time that the electron goes away and comes back, and so the time for spreading is relatively short.
It's not the shortest; it's very short than what we need. So it's sort of. For shortest is the longest,
okay.
For longest is the shortest.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. But in the middle, you can have quite long trajectories contributing.
Well, but of course, experimentalists, you know, then they won't look at those.
Okay. Yeah, but they only look at short trajectories, so for short trajectories, cutoff would be the longest.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes. Because they only look at this front part of the 3EP curve, which means this.
Yeah, that's what you said.
Yes. Which makes me kind of ask a question, because I remember when people came up with recollision model, there was such a thing as Coulomb refocusing of the wave packet which comes back, which allowed to explain the difference in a simplistic model of double non-sequential ionization and the experiment. And I have never heard, at least in this one, about this, you're focusing for high harmonic generation. I mean, I kind of, there is a gap between when I was doing these things and what I'm doing now, like 10 years probably. But I remember there was a lot of speculations about this Coulomb refocusing of the wave packet in the context of double ionization, and I didn't know anything about refocusing effect in the context of high harmonic generation. However, it seems to be the same recollision mechanism, right?
Yes.
So, just for my education, is there any effect of Coulomb refocusing and scaling, and effect on the scaling of the Coulomb refocusing for high harmonic generation?
Very, very good question. Well, what I could say is that Bergdorfer included the Coulomb field, as did Agostini and DeMauro, whoever did the calculation in the paper. They solved the time Schrödinger equation directly. We got the same scaling using short-range potential model.
So you're saying the answer is no effect?
The answer is rather simple, at least at the surface, that the Coulomb focusing comes from the fact that trajectory can miss the parent ion on the first return, but get deflected slightly.
Okay.
And then it is turned around by the field again and smacks right into the target.
Right.
And then that plays a dramatic role in multiple ionization. But such long trajectories, which spend a lot of time in the continuum, play virtually no role in harmonic generation, and I can explain why. So the first statement is such long trajectories do not contribute to high harmonic generation unless you work really hard at seeing and specifically target your experiment to their contribution.
So basically the answer is that there is a difference in recollisional ionization and harmonic generation, which makes contribution of such tricky trajectories not such efficient.
And this difference is that with harmonic generation you look at light, with double ionization you look at electrons. And light, since you look at the macroscopic response from the medium, there is a propagation effect. And that is propagation effects. It's the reason which kills these trajectories.
Propagation, you mean like phase matching?
Linear propagation.
Okay, well, that's a phase matching.
Yes.
There is no phase matching for electron ionization.
Yes, not a problem.
But there is phase matching for high harmonic generation, for sure.
That's actually what makes this high harmonic so beautiful, because you can really isolate very short times. And if you're a hero like Ahmed Zahir, who gave a talk at our conference, you can specifically look at the long trajectories and then the longer and super long and isolate the effects.
It's basically
for each trajectory. So it's really nice.
Basically, it's time result scattering. You can look how this.
I have to go, but are people around this afternoon? Because I'd be interested in kind of discussing some other aspects of your talk and looking at some of the things.
I will be here until about 4, and I have.